Grinning likely, real nine. Any other memories of being on the first position?
Not really, you know. We were there just over maybe 10 days or 4 days. It seemed very long, but it was extremely valuable because it gave us this actually being in the line, you know, and getting into the routine of sleeping by day and working at night. And getting our administration right, you know, getting our, especially this time, our largest American Russians, which were 24-hour packs. I don't think we actually had a good time doing it. I might be wrong. I know at first we had done American Russians, and then eventually, much too easily, our own cook had it going. Started getting bully beef and bread and potatoes, and most of that piece of it. The American sort of pork and beans had great at first, but after a while, you get a bit sick of it. And we got used to routine, you know, like the air panels, for example, red and yellow panel, red horizontal and yellow vertical on the home side of the hill, so that you can see the our planes and make a mistake with bombing them like that. And I think it was a good move, actually, that it gave the time to try to settle down.
Did you have any visitors to the battalion? I'm thinking of high-ranking visitors. Did they arrive from time to time?
At my level, yeah. I know them. The biggest visitor was probably the colonel came around, and he came around fairly regularly, I must admit. And of course, we saw Reggie Atkins from the company command virtually every day, every night, if you say it, and actually had a work with them.
Most of the senior officers were ex-World War II, I think, that we did discuss. And they would have seen a lot of fighting in World War II. Obviously, that was a great interest, a great help to the battalion. But did they show any signs of being, shall we say, less eager to go forward or go into action, having gone through so much in the past?
I don't think so. In fact, almost the reverse. Like I told you before, but of the company commanders, we had two killed and one wounded, which is a high proportion. That was a major. And certainly two of them, in fact, Donoghue and Joy Fasona, need not have been where they were. Doing things which possibly someone should have been doing, which should have been not quite as far forward. But it gave us great sense of confidence in the fact that they had all had this war experience and knew what was going on. And you had great faith, people like Reddy. Reddy used to insist on getting as much ammunition forward as possible, for example. And, at the time, you think, oh God, I'm not carrying more ammunition grenades forward. But this was from his own experience. In fact, if anything did go wrong, then he didn't have the time to go back and get it. It was better to order. So we plugged away to do the kill. How much actual tactical relevance had, say, to have been in the desert, had to clear, was probably doubtful. In fact, at one time, he got very low with Reggie because he thought the latrines dug so deep that they became self-consuming. And while it was, 10 degrees of frost, it was very hard to dig that deep down. But it was only damn deeper, very self-consuming.
You were only on that position for about 10 days, then you moved into reserve. And where was this reserve position in relation to the where you'll be?
It was very far back. I guess it was just about 7 or 8 miles. It was back then. Going back towards Seoul, but almost within sight of 355, I think, still. And this was like a training area, like a reserve area. That far back that we couldn't have gone forward again quickly.
And do you recall what you were doing there? You're saying you're training, but were there leisure pastimes as well? And
well, there are. I think there was a lot of training exercises and sport and marching, shooting, and music. It was probably time for football. Remember the canteen is going, but the officer's mess and things going. You go back to bathrooms, all extremely welcome. And there were shows where you started. Ted Ray came out once, and we went back to a live show. And there were film shows that we did. And again, a couple would take people to brigade headquarters for all the film shows. They may not even be one in the battalion. Like, I rather think we have to go back a bit further to the cinema, which was shared with one of the units.
The Americans entertain you at all, do you recall?
No, not really. We were almost a self-contained division. We just sort of came across them, if you like, rather than mingle with them. The only phase I remember, actually, much later, it was Christmas when we were having an officer's mess dinner back at, I think it was earlier, 3 by then, at Camp Casey. And we used to change, if you like, in the evening, into a woolly pullover and wear a green, little green scarf, a cravat, if you like, and try and look a little bit more civilian-like for dinner. And this guy arrived at his wedding, and he's turned out to be an agent, and he's hanging on. Remember, I get the RSM and take all this dangerous stuff away, put in the guard room until he was going home. You know.
Was mail coming through to you quite well?
Quite. Good regular mail service, and this is we're taken back each day by the colour sergeant. When you put the Russians up, you would take mail back. We got parcels as well, of course. The mayor of Durham organised a very good compass fund, so that virtually every man beside was a parcel from the mayor of Durham fund. This contained paperback book, soap, toothpaste, and all sorts of little goodies, which were very much appreciated. I haven't got wireless, I think. There was one wireless per platoon or something. So on that line, it was using the radio.
In past episodes, in the earlier wars, usually the Salvation Army seemed to appear very close by. Did they get into Korea?
Excellent, yes. So when you went back to the A from the B from, you went down these dusty roads, which were quite amusing because they were maintained by the American by and large. They had great bulldozers and kept them clear. But they put up these very large signs saying, beware of soft shoulders or dangerous curves ahead. And that was quite amusing. But on the way back, there was a nappy canteen on the roadside. And I think the most forward one of all was the Salvation Army, which was absolutely excellent. But I've always had a soft spot for the Salvation Army ever since.
Were there any problems, to your knowledge, in the battalion or in your company or platoon with men who got concerned about what was happening back at home? Dear John letters or family problems?
I had two, but they weren't actually one before I got there. One was one odd thing that you wouldn't think about. So one man had gone out and joined the regular army on a Saturday morning and hadn't got around to telling his wife he was going to do it, that sort of thing. So, he didn't really have much sympathy with people like that. Another one was wondering why his parents weren't writing to him. And eventually it turned out, in fact, that on the last night of leave, he started a fire in the house and gone off. Luckily, they hadn't been hurt, but they could have been. He was wondering why they weren't selling him cake. But, odd thing, there was one or two who who wanted a bit of help with writing letters and things like that. I can't recall anything really serious now, nothing that we have to send anybody home for or in the law of suffering or anything like that. Little silly things.
Was there a punishment area within the battalion situation? Was there a punishment area that soldiers could spend some time in if they
there was a battalion the road somewhere, I can't think of it. And of course, the there was a Commonwealth divisional glass house way back somewhere after Rhea where people did get sent back. And I had two of my platoons came from there. And they'd been in the KSLI, and because they spent so much time in the glass house, they hadn't completed their length of overseas service, so they were sent to us again. Two real hard characters, I won't tell you their names. One came from Time Dock and one from Gerald. And they were really cowardly part. There were people who would beat people up in a bar, but when they actually gone in the line, they would be very loath to go. And on one occasion, one of them we called it sick because he had boils at the NOC. He must have had it for nearly a week beforehand, and rather than trying to get a seat to just put off until the day you had to go in the line, by which time that was really horrible. And he was known to cry when the mortar bomb fell near him, so eventually smallest national servicemen didn't have that respect for him.
They didn't, that kind of person didn't affect the overall spirit of the battalion, presumably.
No. One of them, in fact, turned out to be a very good cook, actually. We made a cook. And I had a sergeant called McCool, Charlie McCool, who had been a heavyweight boxer for BOR. And they were the people in charge. It's just Charlie would just have a word with them quietly. And that seemed to solve the problem quite quickly. But I made one mistake with them. I put them both on guard one night at the. We got sent back to guard a particularly important bridge over the Indian River called Pinto Bridge. And it was one where, in the past, the Chinese had come down the river, which started off on their side of the line, and mined the bottom of it. So it was very important. It was the main highway. And platoons went back to guard this bridge. And then some stupid reason, I put these two X and Y on the same edge of the bridge together, and within half an hour they disappeared and turned over to some engineer's canteen about a mile down the road. And I put them on close arrest and 24/7. And Charlie said, just leave them to me. And after about half an hour, they decided they were going to stay and be good boys again. So that was it. And if you sent these people back, you were just shorthanded.
And knowing them, presumably, you were always aware and had to keep an eye on them in that sense.
I mean, there were very little to do apart from things like that. But I was very much found a job for them where they were separated and couldn't do much harm, if you like. And they did a good job of things. But you usually you'd want it to be interesting.
After being in Area 3, I think it was, for that reserve period, you moved back up to the same positions that you'd originally left?
Yeah, I think that time, I think we swapped around until the four companies became reserve companies and vice versa. That seemed to be the pattern for a while. So, but the reserve companies tend to spend more time working by day and then did more patrols and things like that, working classes and so on, than the forward companies did. But I think we took over from the head of the Black Watch. I think it was the Duke of Wellington who came in from after we took over from there. Back at that reserve place, we just spent quite a bit of time on quite big exercises, A against B company, B against D company, and things up and down the hills. And they were quite fit again by then. It was still the autumn, wasn't it? And I think we also did some work on the reserve land. Going back to something that we called Kansas land, where we put up barbed wire and things, and prepared a reserve defensive line, which we've got to pull back with Kansas too.
And was this dug on World War One lines in deep trenches and so forth?
Well, there were deep trenches eventually. We started off with one slip trench, and then we started off linking over, and we linked the tools up to come with the quarters, and we kept making them deeper and safer as we went on. So we were never really satisfied with them. We always had to improve the overhead cover, take some off and make it better and deeper and stronger, put drains in, we bet the size with sandbags and pickets, improve the camouflage, keep it clean, of course. Especially the Americans tend to throw their trash cans over the top, and we if you're very, very careful not to throw rubbish over the top because of the hygiene factor, and B, because it gives the position away to it. So I think we've got a good reputation for having good defensive field work. Like I said before, the Australians call it beautification because we never say, well, it's finished, it might be better. How do you improve the hutchery, of course? If you're living the hole in the ground, the more comfortable you can make it, the better. So gradually, you've got better stones, you've got better beds, you've got shelves, more lighting, more insulation, and so on.
What are your memories of this second position? Where were you? Were you in the front or in reserve?
Reserve was the second time. I can't remember much about that one for some reason. It wasn't very spectacular, but
there were two.
Didn't really stand up in my mind particularly.
There were two, I think, major raids carried out, Operation Willington and Bladen. I mean, yeah, they were in that time.
We weren't involved in them. I think our job was simply we just stood to that night and the noise couldn't go there. One night, in fact, we supported Black Box had been attacked on the hoop and we fired little machine guns and support of him across the valley. The company didn't actually do any raids. Nothing against big company for that, it was just about that. So I think the raid company and big company was just so kind of what it was like.
When you did have casualties, mines or whatever it was, did the men, deal with those situations quite well?
We had I think the one where we had somebody who was in with a grenade, in a set trench, one of these accidents that he did. And when we heard the band, the next thing was this one of the guys came into the platoon command post carrying another chap on his shoulders. And we put him on the bed and started looking for obvious signs of injury and so on, and we couldn't find him. By which time we turned around and the bloke we carried him in was then sort of sliding slowly down the wall. And he was the one who'd been injured, in fact, but he didn't seem to have had any pain or anything until then. And the other one that must have been just knocked out with the blast or so, which is winded. And so this came in. So we had primitive facilities, but we had usually somebody's platoon who was a bit of a chain sort of first aid captain. We put a speed dressing on them. And then the big thing was to get them back as quickly as you could. You got them back to company headquarters where there was better facilities there. There was a regimental sentry there. And then we put them on a jeep and take them back to the regimental aid post, which was probably about as far back again, where the doctor and his team worked on it. And off the helicopter back to your match. You know, if you watch a match on television, that's how it worked. In fact, it was very good. And the cousins were evacuated very quickly and got very good attention.
Was there any way in which the battalion headquarters let all of the platoons and companies know what were going on in general? You know, did you receive information in that sense?
Yes, I mean, every day we had a company in the all group, and from that you would tell us what was happening in the battalion picture. We used to get sitbacks about the Americans, about the division as a whole. And so we knew pretty well what was going on. Some were so far away that it's quite low on the day, and either turn around with casualties, the Americans probably carried out that weekend. They worked on some formula like a log table, fire somebody around, and that meant you kill 8.2 people or something.
In Chinese.
Chinese, yes. It's a nice looking body.
And you say you're in reserve. Do you recall any particular patrols or activities that you were personally involved in on this second and the second situation?
Which I must confess, I was terrified of. I think ambush patrols, most of them, when you get over 12 or 20 people, you get a great sense of belonging. On the record patrol, when there's just two of you, you seem totally isolated and also very vulnerable. Going across these paddy fields, there was snow or something like that, and it seemed to be like a fly on wallpaper or something. And spent a lot of time stopping the movement and making sure the wires wasn't turned up too loud. And trying to pick out bearings. I think some people see very well in the dark. I don't know if I saw very well in the dark. And you had to keep making sure that you remember which tree it was and looked at all. That we're looking for, and you didn't fall over things when you're going out. So each one of us, that was a corporal actually, and a wireless set. And we had to go up the spur and see if we could find out what's happening. Well, at the bottom of the spur, and there was some people digging in so that we could hear them digging and talking and so on. And we just
did you black your face and so on for these?
Oh, yes.
Cork or chalk or what? Chalk or cork?
Yeah, we've got a camouflage cream thing and tin tent, like it's polished up this way. And you have to take all letters and documents and things off and make sure that your equipment doesn't jump up and down and test these things, tie it. Things will be down on the bend and a little bit of string, so it didn't carry a spare magazine, carry a few grenades, a few phosphorus grenades, because they were quite useful in that they'd smoke, you know, they gave off smoke as well as being a different explosion, but you get a little smoke if you want to. So you probably had two of those and
and you were well briefed before you went, presumably.
Oh, yes. I mean, it was grounded in theory, you knew well, because you could overlook it during the day. It was the land just in front of you. And the places you tend to have been to, you tend to go to where the track crosses the stream or to the little knoll and so on. But even then, on a very, very dark night, it's amazing how things can make you look different. How little knowledge in bushes can make you feel very frightened.
How did you navigate when you're out in no man's land, in effect?
We navigated simply because we sort of knew the ground. We looked at aerial photographs and maps. I never had to do anywhere where I had to need to use a compass to do the night navigation. And there's also the searchlight at Panmunjom where the peace talks are going on, which also gave you a bearing. Just the fact that you knew where the stream went to bend and you just find it like that. I think they're always frightened if you got away from your own battalion position that you'd be coming in front of back into strangers in the line and you didn't know where their sunny patrols were or what happened. So you're always good cautious, remembering what the passwords were. quite frightening when you hear someone cocking their brains in or something. It just becomes really in the same thing like Weetabix, and you're trying to think what the reply is quickly, you know. But that's the way it works.
Was there any liaison with the units on either side to let them know that you had patrols out or they had patrols out?
Yes.
You always knew along the stretch of front.
Yes. And you also had, I mean, you were back in wireless communication, back to company headquarters, so it wasn't long distances. You also had the series of code words, so that you could always bring down mortars or machine guns or artillery fire on pre- chosen points, like River Crossing, that was the road, you could say something like Mallard or something, and it would bring down the 3-inch mortars if you went, if it was a problem. But always concerned as well, you know, if you're suddenly faced with about 20 or 30 China advancing towards you, whether you're lost and hope they don't see you, or you get up and run. I've never had to make that decision, but afterwards is what you would do, you know.
It must have been
not easy.
Must have been quite a stressful situation. You know,
oh, very glad to be back, obviously. I think it was one of my top of two or three whiskies. You know, when you came back, you found over the moon. I haven't got it over. But the adrenaline was going all the time, I think. Any imagination at all, you must be on top notch, aren't you? I mean, you're living in Australia and watching.
In the second situation, you were into the winter.
Yeah.
What conditions were you now facing?
Well, it was extremely cold, and I think it'll get 20, 30 degrees of frost. Very, very cold indeed. And it was the fact that it was the wind as well. I got a chill factor from the wind in Korea, which was blowing straight down from Siberia, made it about 10 times worse. So you got extra problems, and that you couldn't really patrol too long. You know, as you got colder and colder, the more for shorter and shorter periods. You can't lie out there in that cold for 2 hours or something. So you might do for half an hour for cold weather. And the other problem was, of course, that you've got. Someone on sentry who's standing in a slip trench. The great temptation was to put his parka hood up over his ears or to put a blanket over his head, in which case he couldn't hear anything. So he had to keep going around at night and shouting, boo, with their ears over his head, kicking in the backside, to try and stop them doing it. But, the temptation was very, very real. It's freezing cold to cover your ears up. You get frost in your eyeballs, that sort of thing. So you had to change them around again. The sentries didn't do very long, they kept changing all them. Went back into the rest for a warm. And you put them on in pairs so they kept each other away.
Had you been issued with winter clothing?
We had winter clothing, I think, by now. And when we got winter clothing, it was absolutely superb. Long John underpants, white long johns. And then you got winter. It's like the battle as they have nowadays, the wind and showerproof stuff. And then you had thicker stuff that would go over the top of that. So you have big parka which was fur lined. And you had the parachute was smocks, but they were like 3 times as big and and they were absolutely cool. And they had a hood that came up, and then of course you had two or three pairs of gloves. The main thing you were taught was to keep your wrists, ankles, and your head warm because the blood vessels were nearest the skin in your wrists. So we used to wear mitts, with fingers, and we had a short putties that wrapped around the ankles.
And was this all British made stuff?
Yes. Superb. They were boots when they were wet, which were marvellous boots with rather high sort of boots because they had a plastic insole which insulated your foot and gave you a cushion there between the top and bottom. Marvellous boots, really lovely.